Mr. Rev Hoddle, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, good to be here.
Thank you very much for joining. So today we have chatted before, and shout out to Gary for putting us in touch via Noster to talk about capital and the different forms of capital. And I confess, I listened to a couple of the episodes you shared with me, and you touched on permaculture in a way that I'd never understood before. I mentioned a couple of resources, and so I bought a permaculture book and was pumping through that and didn't finish it, which is so often the way, isn't it? It's like, damn it, didn't get through it all. But that's what I'd love to focus on today, is the different forms of capital that you are stewarding, blending together. What are they and why are they important? So, Reb, so what is capital?
Well, yeah, to start off, I guess it's good to put a definition of capital out there. And really, what capital is, it's any productive asset. And that doesn't necessarily mean in the physical world. You can also have productive assets in, like, as far as intellectual capital or experience goes. And so you can also utilize capital as far as your mind, as well as the things that you wield in the physical world. But it's basically anything that you can utilize to produce something.
Okay. And I actually almost haven't said it, or haven't heard it said as succinctly as that. So anything productive that you can utilize. My framing for this, Rev, is not the permaculture one. And that's what I enjoyed so much about listening to some of the work you've been doing, but more from a multi-generational wealth planning perspective. And listeners to the podcast will know my backstory, but just to very briefly share with you the, let's say, problem point where I started this journey from, which was the sudden death of my father. And he was a wealthy guy. I was the eldest son. We had a bit of real estate that I ended up deciding to sell. And so I received an inheritance. And you have this pot of financial capital that you're like, what the hell do I do with this? Like, obviously, I need to steward it effectively to give to my kids when that eventually happens. And, you know, cue over a decade of trying and failing to use different asset classes and realizing that actually this thing, Bitcoin, is just by far and away the best tool for intergenerational wealth management, in my opinion. But that's opened up a whole research process of like, well, actually, that's just financial capital. And the episode I did recently with Jason Parks, who's a mentor of mine, we're looking very closely at the blend of financial capital, but with humanistic and intellectual. So how I would think about it is you need humanistic wealth and intellectual wealth, or humanistic capital and intellectual capital, to drive financial returns. And how I would define humanistic is really like the relationship with your partner, the children that you actually have, and intellectual being your mindset and the skills that you have to provide to the world. And with those two together, you're actually then able to drive financial returns. But a common problem seen in many families is this shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves problem, where you get a, much like the cyclical seasons, right? You get some tough, strong, aggressive entrepreneur that sees an opportunity and builds something. And the generation that follows them saw it getting built, and they're able to then keep it going a little longer. But generation number three, so the founder's grandkids, they've only ever known wealth. They've never known what it felt like to have nothing. And often what that means is that the life cycle of wealth is only three generations. And by the fourth generation, they're back figuring out how to start again. And so the lens of financial, humanistic, and intellectual is very important when it comes to, like, how do you try and sustain that over multiple generations? Does any of that resonate? And let's try and weave in some permaculture stuff, because there's, you know, there's cultural capital, there's social capital, there's relationship capital. There's so many different kind of areas to it, essentially.
Well, permaculture is basically the framework that you can use to break that cycle. That's the whole goal of permaculture, ultimately, is to build capital and save capital for future generations, and not just for the next few, but for many leading forward. And the framework of permaculture, utilizing the ethics and principles, creates this guide that now you can prevent yourself from making these mistakes intergenerationally. Because, you know, if you break the word down, permanent culture, that's not necessarily to say that it's permaculture's goal is to create an ossified and unchanging culture, but more so a culture that is capable of withstanding any challenges, any uncertainty, and how to basically have a big enough savings to insulate against any of the things that might come up as time goes on.
Okay. And so how does permaculture look to develop savings?
Well, first there's some ethics involved in permaculture, and any culture is ultimately built upon ethics. And so in permaculture, the three ethics are earth care, people care, and the third ethic I call non-extraction. Now, David Holmgren and Bill Mollison, the founders of permaculture, they define the third ethic as redistribution of the surplus back to the system. And so that's kind of a wordy way to follow up the simple ethics of earth care and people care. And so people have tried to shorten this third ethic in the past. And most people that practice permaculture arrive at calling the third ethic fair share. Now, fair share lends itself to a little bit of a more open interpretation, I think. It's less straightforward than simply saying non-extraction. And so that's why I call the third ethic non-extraction. And in addition to the ethics, there's also 12 principles in permaculture. And these principles you use to design and interact with complex systems. And cultures are complex systems, economies are complex systems, and ultimately economies are derived from cultural systems. And so utilizing these ethics to build and interact with these systems, observe complex systems, allows you to have this framework, which then you can use to continue to build capital and maintain the savings of that capital for future generations.
Okay, and so I just was quickly checking the resource that you mentioned. So I was reading The Essence of Permaculture by David Holmgren, and I could probably see 81% of the way through. I'm at principle 10, and I really, really enjoyed it. What I think I struggled with is the Bitcoin journey has made me more libertarian, more free market oriented. And this third ethic of giving back or sharing, somehow it's a contradiction to some of those more like hardcore libertarian views, because it's like, it's not yours what you created. I don't know, is that like, do you kind of see what I'm saying there? So this idea of giving back at the end, it's like, why should I give it back? So perhaps you could help me understand a bit more why that's such an important part of the permaculture ethic process.
Well, and I think that's where this misinterpretation of that third ethic comes in. As it's been shortened to fair share, this lends itself to more communistic, socialistic mindsets.
Yeah, that's what I got struck by. Like, that's a really socialistic kind of frame. It's like, well, hang on. Why would I? Yeah, that didn't sit very well with me as I was researching the concepts, put it that way.
Yeah, so you can, we can maybe use like natural systems. A lot of times permaculture, when people hear about permaculture, they start learning about permaculture. They think about it through the lens of farming, gardening, things like that, right? So we can take an example. I raise sheep here at the homestead. I've got a 20-acre homestead. I've been living this homesteading lifestyle for about 10 years, and I've integrated Bitcoin into it for the last 5. And so with my sheep, I rotationally graze these sheep. Now, the name of the game here is to maximize the stocking density of the 10 acres of pasture that I have in order to produce the most lamb meat in a given season. So essentially, I'm just trying to catch as much sunlight as possible, turn that into grass, feed the grass to the sheep, and then get the maximum yield I can out of it. Now, as I improve and get more experience rotating these sheep and see some success in that, the tendency here is to push more and more and more. And ultimately, when you're stressing the pasture out, when you're trying to maximize the yield you can get, you can start to create an extractive mindset around it, or an extractive tendency. And see, this is where I see the difference between fair share and non-extraction when it comes to interpreting this redistribution of the surplus back to the system.
Yes, so it's not like it's not a forced. Sorry to jump in, Red, but it's really got my brain going. It's not an enforced socialization of the gains, which would be, you know, some form of taxation. It's like, okay, these are all the net earners in the economy, and you're going to take 50% of your shit to give to everyone else and us because you achieved that. It's actually like, if you want optimal growth of your ecosystem, don't overgraze, which would be, that's the yes, okay, cool. I love that. So non-extraction is the critical shift in your terminology there.
Right, because if you start to overgraze, then you're starting to degrade the land, and you're
not building capital.
Right, you're starting to go.
You're starting to chip away at it. Yes, okay.
But humans, we tend to try and push that limit. That's it's just what's basically caused the downfall of cultures and civilizations over and over again. And a lot of times, when you look at it through the lens of money, right. We have a lot of times this fiat money works for a while, but then people start to say, hey, there's some games I can play here to get a little bit more. And then they start to extract more and more and more until there's so much extraction that the system ultimately fails. And so the reason why it's an ethical thing is because it's very hard to define what extraction actually is. It's got to be coming from your own interpretation of that. I guess that's what separates it from it being a principle. Because it's very hard to quantify.
And so I'm intrigued. There's so many different ways I'd like to take this, but how you described your journey thus far is permaculture was something you came across before Bitcoin, and Bitcoin has been incorporated into those concepts. So let's initially start with this then, this idea of non-extraction. Did you used to consider that third ethic as non-extraction? Or was there a problem or pain point that you came across when aiming for this permaculture future that meant that you kind of got it wrong and you were actually chipping away at that capital?
Not necessarily. I didn't agree with this. I just never really understood the terminology of fair share never really spoke to me because it was very hard for me to understand. Like, yeah, if I produce extra lamb and I have it in my freezer, does that mean I've got a surplus and therefore I should distribute it to my community for free. These kinds of ideas just didn't really make sense to me. And so I just kind of let that stew in the background over. I mean, I've been practicing permaculture since I started studying it in about 2011, 2012, and I really put it into use in 2015 when I got the homestead here. And so really I've been actively practicing permaculture for 10 years. And so over the course of those 10 years, I've started to, that's basically where this change came from is like, I don't see it as a fair share. It's hard to define that. It's hard for me to understand it. Eventually this realization of, oh, I just have to make sure that I'm not extracting from my systems. And that's how I maintain the savings. Obviously, if you're extracting, like you said, you're not saving. You're not building capital. You're basically taking from somewhere else to subsidize the production and success of your system that you're working with.
Okay. And something that resonated when I was listening to you on some other episodes, like I mentioned, was this idea of like, how can you blend two forms of capital at the same time? And you were talking about how you've learned certain techniques on the homestead where you're looking to constantly develop a state of symbiosis by which two forms of capital are actually growing together. Teach me a bit more about how that works.
Well, so there's this concept of capital building in permaculture has been broken down into 9 forms. And this is something that I've changed. Actually, I was taught that it's the 8 forms of capital, but as I've been practicing this framework and thinking about it more, I've added a 9th form, which we can get to. But it really all comes down to the expenditure of your time, because that's the currency, essentially, that you're using to build any form of capital, right? And time is something that is a flow. It's not when people talk about saving time, you can't actually save any time. You can only spend it more efficiently. And so even when you're sleeping, you're spending time. So if you can find a way with one unit of expenditure of your time to build more than one form of capital at once, now you're maximizing the efficiency and expenditure of your time. And so I can break down these nine forms real quick. And I kind of have it separated now. Now that there's nine forms, it really becomes easy to break the nine forms into three, what I call super forms of capital. So you've got your physical capital, and that would be your money, your financial capital, material capital, and natural capital. Then it goes into the second super form, which is your personal capital, the stuff that's relating to yourself as an individual. That's where the intellectual capital, the experiential capital comes in. And this is the ninth form that I've added, which I call vital capital, which is your mental health and your physical well-being. Mm-hmm. After the personal capital and the physical capital, now you've got relational capital, which is how you're utilizing the relationships that you have, your interactions with the world and the idea around the world. So that's social capital, cultural capital, and then spiritual capital. What are your ideals? What's your life's purpose? That sort of thing. And so when you're spending your time, basically you're trying to find ways to build as many of these nine forms of capital at once. And this creates one, a good diversity or when you rebalance your portfolio, right? You've got this
reallocation.
Yeah, a good spread of a web of different forms of capital to lean on. And so then you can start to liquidate one form of capital for another and rebalance to get this nice resilient base of capital, which that creates when, like I said, when society and problems and issues happen, instead of just relying on financial capital to buy you out of the situation, you might already have the capital that you need that will ease you through that hard time in advance.
So you might be able to, for example, draw down on some spiritual capital. So you might be in a moment of severe grief or a relationship is broken down and you've already got stored capital in the spiritual sense that you can actually use at that time. Or equally, and I'm just trying to kind of brainstorm some concepts, like you need a skill, you don't have it, you don't necessarily want to use financial capital to attain it, but your network is so developed that you're like, actually, I know a guy that I can go to who's got the exact skill that I need to do this, and I can get the job done faster in exchange for maybe a different form of capital, your own time, or something else. Okay. And
maybe you've already got a favor built up with this person where they're happy to accommodate, right? And that's where the social capital would come in.
I mean, an example of this would be that at least I see in one of my motivations for content creation is you're putting stuff out there without necessarily being paid, but people get value from it. So one of the, in a sense, bets that I'm making is that by putting out interesting information on a regular basis that people enjoy, you're actually building a form of relationship capital without asking for anything. And so if I suddenly was to ask for something, I might well see lots of people come back and say, I can help you do this, I can help you do that. It's worth testing in some ways. But in your case, Rev, how does that actually convey into, like, do you have any stories of specific moments when you've actually kind of put that concept into practice?
Well, if we want to talk about it through the lens of Bitcoin, my favorite example is a Bitcoin meetup.
Yep.
So a lot of people, when they think about a Bitcoin meetup, it's just you might be going to a bar or a restaurant or a coffee shop, and with the goal of just meeting other Bitcoiners, talking about Bitcoin. And so when you show up to this meetup, you're spending your time and maybe you're building some social capital and maybe some intellectual capital around Bitcoin. But as I've gone to, I use Bitcoin meetups as a way to access the Bitcoin market, right, as an economy. Mm-hmm. So when I started going to a meetup, the meetups, that was my initial experience. All right, cool. I get to meet some people, meet other Bitcoiners locally, talk about Bitcoin, and now I've got these relationships that I have access to. But then I started to think, well, I've heard that, you know, earning Bitcoin is one of the best ways to acquire it, and especially because you're earning KYC-free Bitcoin. And so I thought to myself, well, I've got some extra maple syrup. I produce maple syrup here at the homestead. Why not at the next meetup, I'll bring some jars of syrup and see if anyone wants to buy them and pay in Bitcoin. I brought the syrup, and sure enough, I sold out all the syrup. And I was like, that's interesting. This is pretty cool. And the people there were like kind of surprised too. Like, wait a second. this guy's got something I can, a lot of times when I bring these items to the meetups, this is someone's first opportunity to actually spend their Bitcoin on it.
Yeah,
good.
I've had similar scenarios. Yeah.
And so there was some excitement around this, like, whoa, this is cool. And it became obviously, you know, I use Lightning primarily, when I'm doing these transactions, just because of the convenience. And it's better for a lot of reasons when you're just selling something for $10. But so as we've all heard, you know, a lot of times, especially this was several years ago when I started doing this, there's issues when it comes to transacting in Lightning. Transactions fail, all kinds of who knows what things come up. And so now we're actually getting some experience spending our Bitcoin because we're having to troubleshoot how to actually make this transaction work. And so that might lead to different kinds of solutions, right? Instead of showing up with just one Lightning wallet, now I make sure that I've got a couple different options in order to not miss out on a sale because my particular Lightning wallet isn't jiving with whatever that person's got to send me the Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So now we're building experience by spending our Bitcoin. So now we're building social capital. We're building intellectual capital, talking about Bitcoin, and we're building experiential capital by spending the Bitcoin. And I'm now starting to build financial capital by selling the stuff. And people started to see like, whoa, if this guy's showing up with something to sell, maybe I've got something. And now at like the Southwest Michigan meetup, which is the closest meetup to where I live, I can buy honey, coffee, pork, beef, yogurt, a lot of different food staples to where I'm actually kind of making a grocery trip at the same time as I'm selling some of my stuff. So now we're building this little mini circular economy. So I'm leaving not only with financial capital, but some material capital. Maybe I bought several Bitcoin miners through these meetups, and then also some natural capital. And a lot of times when I talk about natural capital is essentially your ability to produce food or food. And so you can start to see through one evening of going to this Bitcoin meetup, I'm stacking all of these different forms of capital at once.
Mm. It's very interesting, isn't it? My example of this is on the receiving end of that. I went to a meetup. So I'm originally from the UK, Rev, but now live in Australia and dove down the rabbit hole, having owned Bitcoin for a long time, 2020, all the warning signs going off. You're like, what the hell is going on out there? And as an investor, I'm always looking for opportunities. And it's like, hang on, there's a company that put Bitcoin on the balance sheet. I've owned it for 5 years, best investment I've ever made. Hang on, this is a big deal. I've got to get close to this thing. And wow, the last 5 years has changed my life. But as part of the process, going to physical meetups was very important because as a extrovert, I was already online kind of talking about shit. And suddenly it just became very Bitcoin focused. And at the time, it was Twitter. It's like, my God, what's all this stuff going on? And I went to one called the Bitcoin Bush Bash, which is it's like a geographically mobile meetup. So they do one in most of the different states of Australia once a year. And this particular one was Victoria, about 4 hours drive from Melbourne, where I was living at the time. And I went there and there was a guy who'd brought his espresso machine and he was pumping out espressos in the morning. And I went and paid him in Bitcoin. And you're like, oh my God, that was the coolest thing ever. Because yes, you can go through the process like I had of like, all right, if I'm going to actually reallocate in a size that you know, actually is like, if this goes wrong, you've really fucked up your inheritance. So first I had to figure out multi-sig, I had to figure out using something like on-chain capital, I had to figure out, well, what's the inheritance plan? You get hit by a bus tomorrow, you don't want your Bitcoin sitting on a fucking iPhone because your kids aren't going to get it. So I had to put all that in place. And ultimately, the conference experience or the meetup experience was a crucial part of the puzzle because you're not just shouting people online. It was like, oh my God, A, you can just use this stuff. B, here's all of these other people that have asked the same set of questions from extremely different backgrounds and ended up at the similar conclusion. And then you're having a beer with them in the middle of Outback Australia. Like, what the fuck? How did I end up here? But that coffee moment was a really important one. So what you just described resonates very strongly. I have yet to create a product and taken that to a meetup. So that's another step that, you know, one might evolve to. So have other people seen what you were doing and reacted to that in your meetup community? Was it always the case that you could basically do a groceries run when you first took maple syrup, or has that developed since?
Well, yeah, I think that, well, and first of all, this meetup in Southwest Michigan was very new when I started to attend it. I maybe missed the first several, but it was like at the very beginning of it. So there wasn't much time for these things to have developed on their own before I started doing it anyways. But it's kind of like the discovery of fire, you know, like where it's just a good idea whose time has come. And so people figure this out simultaneously, kind of at different meetups at the similar time. Because there was there's a meetup in Southwest Michigan. And then there was shortly after that, a meetup in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is about an hour and a half from that one in Southwest Michigan. And about the same time, somebody started to bring eggs and honey and things like that to that meetup to sell. And so it was just kind of this very beginning stages of it, and it just sort of propped up naturally. Because if you're trying to earn Bitcoin, the best place to earn Bitcoin is where the Bitcoiners are at, right? If you show up to a place with a bunch of Bitcoiners, your chances of earning Bitcoin are much, much higher than just kind of shouting out into the void and just putting a sign at the end of your road at your farm stand saying, I accept Bitcoin, and fishing for the Bitcoiners, right? Mm. And so it just sort of slowly progressed where eventually, so the second guy to start bringing stuff was actually the Daniel, who runs the Southwest Michigan meetup with DK. He didn't necessarily have anything that he was producing, but he had access to this creamery that was close to his place. And, you know, I was like very interested in getting this high quality yogurt. And so he kind of got the idea, well, I can spend my fiat, buy the yogurt, bring it to the meetup, sell the yogurt, give market access to this yogurt to the Bitcoiners. And now I'm basically DCAing my fiat through yogurt into KYC free Bitcoin, and then providing this product that that I want every month. I would love to pick up yogurt. And granted, aside, I started milking sheep and I produce my own yogurt now, but for a long time I was buying all my yogurt through the Bitcoin meetup. And so you don't necessarily have to be producing something per se, to attend the meetup and start earning Bitcoin. You just have to know what that meetup in particular, what kind of products that those people want, and then provide market access to it. You can spend your fiat on that and bring it to the meetup and then turn that product into Bitcoin. And this is a way to basically buy Bitcoin with your dollars through selling a good.
Mm. Wow. And it's this, how do I even describe it? We're so unbelievably early on Bitcoin still, even though one might feel like it's been a big part of their life for half a decade now or more even. But when I hear how you're talking, it just reminds me of how effectively it is a bottom-up viral adoption through people. So how bullish are you, Rev, on the future? And how long is this going to take to play out, do you think? Because it seems clear to me that this blend of sound money and savings technology in the digital world, it overlays with the physical operation that you're creating in a magical way. So that's just one example, or equally like where I came from of like, you know, you get given this money, what the fuck are you going to do with it? Well, actually, this thing called Bitcoin kind of solves all your problems. Where are we in the adoption curve, do you reckon? And because it's so varied, isn't it?
Well, in this kind of, you know, there's this meme of hyper Bitcoinization, merchant adoption, these kinds of ideas. Why can't I just go everywhere and spend my Bitcoin? And granted, with this new Square implementation, it seems like that's more the case. But this was something that I didn't necessarily touch on with that initial story about how many forms of capital you can stack at a Bitcoin meetup. Cultural capital is a huge component of this. Yeah. Because now that we're starting to transact with each other and we're starting to find out, you know, all of the different, like what Lightning wallets work for us, right? Now we just, when a new guy shows up and he's like, what should I use? It's like, well, we're all using this Lightning wallet. It works great for us, you know? And so we're developing our very own subculture within the broader Bitcoin culture. As far as adoption is concerned, it's like the most important thing is the adoption that you create in your own life, in your local, Like, if you want more utility out of your Bitcoin, you just have to go and find the Bitcoiners that are around you and create the opportunities for you to get to utilize your Bitcoin. Another example is, like, there's a corner store down the road from me. Woman died. She was making a lot of food in there. And then some young couple bought the store and sort of took it over and started carrying all of her recipes for it and everything. And so I just liked those people more. As I was going into the store, they were kind of my age and everything. And so I started talking to them, building a relationship. And every time I'd go in there, I'm like, well, you guys, you could figure this out. You want to start accepting my Bitcoin for, you know, when I go and buy beer or smokes or whatever. And they're like, we haven't really quite figured this out yet. And I cracked it was that I found out that they like lamb and I produce lamb. And so I was like, well, hey, do you guys want to buy a lamb? And they're like, oh yeah, that'd be great. And then they actually made the offer of trading me store credit for this lamb.
Very interesting.
And so they had a tab.
It's like a quasi money itself, right?
Yeah, this is another way of, like, basically taking that natural capital that I had and liquidating it for a different form through this corner store, right? And so they had this little piece of paper with how much money was left on my credit. And every time I'd make a transaction there, they'd cross out the thing, write the new total, and then they'd take cash out of their pocket and put it in the till so their books were kept in mm-hmm. order at the end of the day. And so once I ran out of that store credit, I was like, okay, so now we can do the Bitcoin, right? Because it's the exact same thing. You just take your phone out. I pay you for the good or service right to your own personal Bitcoin wallet on your phone. Then you take mm-hmm. cash out of your pocket, put it in the register. They're like, oh, wow, yeah, this is cool. And so now I get to go to this corner store, spend my Bitcoin, buy all my beer, whatever I want there with my Bitcoin. And this is I didn't have to wait for anybody to figure it out. I created it for myself. And now I've got this utility for my Bitcoin that I didn't have before.
Mm, really cool. And you touched on the Square features that have been launched recently. And they've made a big splash in the Bitcoin world. You know, we're all pumped that, like, there's all of these merchants that are now going to be able to, you know, use Bitcoin. And I've had two interesting scenarios in my life recently that chime with what you're talking about, which is a cafe local to where I live and a butcher. And the cafe owner has a Square terminal and is flat out busy, is long altcoins, thinking that they're going to go faster than Bitcoin. So hasn't quite got to the, like, I just want to buy this stuff Bitcoin. And quite simply was, like, keen on having it there. I was like, you could have your little get Bitcoin sign here, but just super busy and not really that interested. And you're like, fair enough, I'm not going to chase that. And the second situation was a farm with a kind of farm shop and butcher's business, which already is accepting Bitcoin, is a sponsor of the local Bitcoin meetup, and is into it themselves. And they are a primary producers, right? They're shifting meat, whether it's, you know, chicken, lamb, beef. And one of the concerns they had, which was really interesting, about using a Square terminal, it's like, if I use Square for Bitcoin, am I going to get flagged in some database somewhere, which is going to kind of give me away? I'd actually much prefer you just to send me Bitcoin to my wallet of Satoshi and not even put it through that thing. And that was a really valid concern, because on top of, they're already taking risk, right? They're not necessarily vaccinating the cows. They're already doing things that they're not told. You know what I mean? They're like, no, I don't want to do that. This is my farm. This is my output. I'm going to do it my way. And they've got a brilliant organic regenerative beef business that people love buying from because it's excellent quality product. But equally, it's like, fight your battles where you can. And maybe implementing that feature is not the best idea. And I don't know whether that is the case, but it was a really interesting piece of feedback from the market, not from some Bitcoin news outlet that's telling you that, you know, everything's going to go to the moon, everyone's going to use Bitcoin because of Square's feature implementation. But, like, what does it mean if I do it this way? Which I thought was really interesting. Like, have you got other people locally that have actually started using it, or any other, like, does that resonate at all?
Well, I think it's a good, it's a good path there, right? When you're trying to orange pill somebody, you don't start with, like, all right, so you have to learn about this thing called KYC, and you have to start thinking about your privacy, and you have to, you know, it's way too overwhelming, right? You just get them set up intense. With generally I set people up on Cash App. All right, it's KYC, but it's better, in my opinion, for people to start interacting with Bitcoin and having some Bitcoin, even if it's KYC Bitcoin. And that gives them the opportunity to go further down the path and get rid of that KYC stuff. Personally, I think that KYC is the biggest threat to Bitcoin of anything that we've got going on right now. To participate knowingly in the KYC ecosystem is unethical, right? Anyways, so there's a couple things going on here when it comes to the Square thing. And this is a heuristic that I've recently started to kind of try and live by. And that's, I try and prioritize spending Bitcoin with people that I have the highest probability of earning that Bitcoin back from. And so like in the example of this corner store, they need eggs and I produce eggs. And so I started bringing them eggs. And guess what? Now the dude buys the eggs from me with Bitcoin. He just takes the Bitcoin, sends it back to me from his wallet. And now I've got like a little miniature circular thing going on. And this was a kind of a cool experiment because the price just happened to be going up when we started this. And so I'm like, dude, watch. Every time I'm going to go buy beer and then I'm going to bring eggs and you're going to buy the eggs from me and you're going to have more Bitcoin left in your wallet over time. And this is going to show you that this is a superior form of savings in addition to this utility that we have. The other thing, the white paper calls Bitcoin peer-to-peer electronic cash, right? The cash-based nature of it when you're interacting peer-to-peer resonates a lot more with people that want to run these cash businesses. That's why the Square thing doesn't necessarily the people that are using Square are not typically running a cash-based business. So it doesn't really there's not much of an incentive for them to switch if they don't already understand Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's a great point, isn't it? So actually they're maybe even a cashless business, right? You often go to a cafe and be like, no cash. And so they've already kind of, yes. But then that's where it's like, privacy is a big deal. And arguably, like, the longer you go along this journey, the more of a big deal it becomes. And it's something that I've started thinking about a lot more. Now, my lens, again, to touch on is like, if you're managing wealth from a TradFi perspective, it's like you own real estate, some equities, some bonds. All of them are normally purchased through some kind of intermediary. And it's KYC to hell, right? It's that's what it is. And so even moving into Bitcoin, but with KYC, you still have self-custody. And that is a superpower over and above all the other illiquidity issues, counterparty issues, credit issues that you might find in the TradFi space. So it's a vast improvement, but it's still like you want to sell all your other shit and buy Bitcoin, but you're not going to be able to do that in a non-KYC fashion. You have to be using the rails that they've kind of funneling you into Bitcoin with via registered exchanges, and you've got to share driving license and all this different stuff. What fascinated me about a book that I read, Renaissance Money. So Andrew Bailey, shout out to Andrew, who'd been on the podcast before. And I learned for the first time about the idea of backwards privacy and forwards privacy when it comes to the use of physical cash. So if you pay me $10, I don't know where that $10 has been. And if I pay someone $10, I don't know where it's going. So that's like backward privacy, forwards privacy. And in the white paper, very clear, peer-to-peer digital cash. But here we are 15 years later, and because of the way that the on-ramp to Bitcoin is so heavily policed by the existing status quo, most Bitcoin is KYC. And I don't know what the breakdown actually is. But if you're smart enough, and this is where a lot of this on-chain stuff gets a bit kind of sketchy, they're able to actually follow exactly what you're doing. So you don't have the privacy in Bitcoin that was initially, I don't think Satoshi envisaged that, put it that way. How do you get around that, Rev, in terms of your processes that you might put in place or the people that you've met, if that makes sense?
So, yeah, I wouldn't say that most of the Bitcoin is KYC'd, but it's very difficult to get started interacting with Bitcoin without starting at the KYC point, right?
Okay.
It's just the most, I guess, accommodating. It's the least friction way to get started.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
And so that's why a lot of people start that way. And it's just, once you're kind of, you're like, well, I've already KYC'd and I don't really see any downside to continuing to participate in this way, it becomes hard to like wean yourself off of it. Because you're ultimately making, a lot of times you're paying a premium if you're buying Bitcoin with dollars, no KYC. There's a lot more friction involved. And so it's hard for people to make that jump. But like you said, as time goes on, you start to think about the long-term effects. Like, all right, so I've got, every time I withdraw from this exchange, and like, dude, the best examples are like these ranch attacks. And granted, these are people that have like millions of dollars, right, of crypto and Bitcoin. But a lot of times how they get targeted is because the attacker finds that they've withdrawn to this address. They can see that the Bitcoin's there on the address, hasn't moved. And so it's like a pretty sure bet. Like, all right, I got your name, I got your address, and I can see that you're in your wallet. You've withdrawn this Bitcoin from the exchange and it's still sitting there. And your keys can protect you to a certain point. But as once they start chopping off the fingers, right, you're going to go and be like, all right, I got multi-sig, but I'm going to stop cutting my fingers off. I'm going to go and get all these keys together and sign and just get the fuck out of my hair. And so the best way to protect yourself is to not have people have visibility into your addresses at all. Right. And this is where the no KYC stuff comes in. It's a much longer term play, aware of this privacy, but it's one of those things where you don't think about in 10 years, if this is going to be a problem for me or not right now.
Yeah, you're dealing with other lower level problems. You know, it's like inflation. Inflation's a fucking problem. Okay, well, how do I get out of that? Well, Bitcoin. Okay, well, how do I buy Bitcoin? Well, this is how you do it. And boom, you do it. But you're right. In 10 years' time, there is no top, right? The Bitcoin price, you know, interestingly, we've had whatever it's been, about 45, 50 days of coming down. Everyone's freaking out about like, oh my God, it's going to zero type thing. And admittedly, like, I'm feeling the heat too. You know, when your net wealth takes a bit of a tumble, all of those like optimistic decisions you were making, I took a bit of leverage to buy a piece of real estate, which I've got to refinance in 2 years' time. You're like, well, I thought 23 months was ages to think about that. But now I'm like, oh shit, I should probably start putting in a place to think about like, what's my plan for 2 years' time? So it's funny how the sentiment shifts, but a decade is a much harder viewpoint to kind of calculate around. And so, I mean, even I'm wondering, how does someone get hold of your name, address, and Bitcoin wallet? Like that attack vector that you mentioned, like, so they've basically like Ledger or someone gets hacked again, and there's your email address and there's your physical address that you got the hardware wallet sent to. And then somehow they're able to get hold of an exchange that you used. And how would they even do that?
Well, so you could think about it like, all right, you get SIM swapped. Maybe you don't hold your Bitcoin on the exchange, but now they can log into the exchange. They can see your addresses that you've withdrawn to. They can see all that history. Mm-hmm. And there you go. Now you've got all the information you need to go and find the person and get the stuff.
Yeah.
And that stuff is just there waiting to be found someday. And 10 years from now, you don't really know, like, all right, the exchange goes out of business or something. Where are those records destroyed? Who has access to
them? What do they do with them? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it actually makes me think about an angle to more recent kind of rabbit hole I'm diving down, which is Noster, and a situation in which it's like, okay, I've fired up a couple of different Noster key pairs and ended up using predominantly one. And now 2 years has gone by and you've got all of this kind of proof of work supposedly connected to your different key pairs. But I also signed up with a bunch of clients when it had no value attached to the key pair. I couldn't even remember the names of some of those clients 2 years ago. And I posted about this relatively recently. And the conclusion was it's extremely improbable or unlikely that those key pairs you shared will cause you any headache in the future. So just crack on with what you're doing and see what happens. But it is something to be wary of, right? It's like, okay, you're logging into all these different clients. Some of them disappear after a couple of weeks. You're receiving sats online. Most importantly, you're building a digital identity that's yours. That's capital. I don't want the threat of my capital being taken away from me if I was to lose my Nostra key pair. So I know that you're active on Nostra as well. Like, how did you end up getting into that? And what's your view on Nostra today? Because it's something that I'm really leaning into.
Well, so I guess this comes down to, once again, the Bitcoin culture and sort of the pillars of any culture that I've kind of arrived at. And there's probably more, but basically it's money is a defining border of culture. Location is a defining border of culture, and your morals and ethics are a defining border of culture. And so the Bitcoin culture is essentially a diaspora, right? Like, we're all spread out. It's very hard. Like, there's a lot of Bitcoiners out there, but we're not really concentrated in too many places to build these effective economies. And so Nostr is like a place. It's a location in which Bitcoiners can go to start to build more cultural capital, because it's not like Twitter where you can be shadow banned and you can have your account suddenly removed and you can't, it's harder to spin up new identities and all of this stuff. And so I think that Nostr is like an incredible, it's the location where Bitcoiners can go to build cultural capital online in a digital way, where we can all come together there in this digital space to build cultural capital. And when it comes to like the rotating of keys, like, all right, if my keys get leaked and something happens, we don't really have too many examples yet of the techniques or things that can be done in order to like basically recover that what you built up, right? Your social graph and all this stuff. I was thinking about trying to like just test out rotating keys and you know, saying like, all right, in 3 months, my keys are going to rotate to this and I'm going to like stop using these keys and you start following me over here and pay and do a post on both of them. But I haven't taken that jump yet because it's just, I'm kind of waiting, you know, to see what somebody else does when they're like some important person or somebody who's built up a lot of this capital in Nostr, to see if their keys get leaked, what do they do and how do they recover from that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking through it. Like, if you were to develop cultural capital through a Nostr account or Nostr key pair, that cultural capital is connected to you. The key pair is a representation of it. So if the key pair was to be compromised in some way, then if you were to spin up another one and share with, you know, the world on Nostr that like my key pair has been compromised, this is my new one. If the cultural capital reserve is strong enough, then you have to assume that a core group of people with other Nostr accounts would switch to the new one. And that web of trust, which is a fascinating concept, is transferable to whatever the new incarnation is. Now, I think about things like, you know, what does a media business look like with Nostr at the center of it? And you're going to have people with information that's being shared as entertainment or as news or whatever it might be, video, short form text, long form articles, maybe even some kind of books. I don't quite know how it will work, but there'll be multiple revenue streams generating sats into some kind of probably holding wallet on the Lightning Network that then will be filtered through to somewhere else. So that there's like it would be kind of like having your operations bank account hacked. So the quicker you can kind of drain that and get it into whatever your longer term treasury account would be as a business, the better. Or equally, if it's just you as an individual, then you'd want to do that. Because whoever gets your key pair would have access to that Lightning wallet to some extent. Maybe there's a way around that too.
They would just, I mean, okay, if I had access to someone's Nostr key pair, I would just switch the Lightning wallet out with something that looks very similar, and they would be zapping instead of me, or instead of the person whose keys.
Yes, you're receiving zaps from other people to your own Lightning wallet.
They're not going to be able to take any of your Bitcoin, but they're just going to be able to, for a short period of time until people realize it, get whatever revenue you'd be earning through the zaps.
Because I've recently been through the process, which I must admit I found pretty painful, but I think I've now done it, of getting a Albi hub set up and having some Lightning channels for the first time that are essentially mine. And previous to that, I was using, and I haven't fully done this as a podcast or as a Nostr account, but Primal have a custodial wallet as part of their client, and Fountain, you know, if you're posting stuff on Fountain, have a custodial wallet, and you can easily switch that out for a Lightning address with Albi. And so actually, as you say that, if someone got the key pair, they could try and log in via Fountain or log in via Primal. But actually, if the wallet was self-custodial via Albi, then you're controlling it somewhere differently anyway. So those custodial wallets would have no exposure if the key pair was compromised. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I didn't think about it in regards of if you're using a client that has a wallet that is controlled by the keys itself, right? This custodial wallet. Like,
but that's where NOS is so cool, isn't it?
Access to the wallet. Now,
it's
that would
taking different bits off the shelf and putting them together in such a way that even if the key pair was compromised, then you're protected on the back end, basically. Yeah, cool. And at this stage, it's still very much like we're playing around with Noster. It's extraordinarily valuable, but like, how do you make a real business with Noster right now? I don't know necessarily. Is there enough people on it to actually create a full-time Noster media business? I'm not sure. And that's what we're all testing and trying. But the fact that, as you quite rightly point out, it's become the meeting place for people who've adopted Bitcoin as sound money, that's already massive, because there's not many people out there that have actually done that in a meaningful way. You know, 50% of assets, Bitcoin, in self-custody. Like, I don't know how many people in the world have actually done that, but it's not very many. And therefore, a place to communicate and convene to do commerce is insanely valuable, but it's almost like a public good because it's a protocol, right? It's actually quite communist in that sense. Like, here's the playground, guys, and you just got to look after it properly. And you can build on it. Wow, cool. So Rev, where I'd love to go now is more back to the homestead side of things. And equally a question I had around these different forms of capital. Like, does debt play into this? Are you able to take leverage and buy a piece of real estate and then do permaculture on top of it? How does the permaculture ethics and forms of capital approach debt?
So, yeah, the what I basically live by here, because fiat money is basically the most extractive system you can observe today, right? That ethically, I'm trying to avoid my interactions with fiat as much as possible. But at the same time, don't hate the player, hate the game, right? So I still live in a fiat world, and I'm going to utilize the advantages that fiat has to my benefit whenever I can. And once again, this is a compromise in my ethics, but you have to make some trade-offs, right? It's hard to, if I tried to be perfect, I wouldn't get anywhere. It's just that the tooling is not set up to be Bitcoin only all the time. So I hold as little dollars for as short a period of time as possible, as much Bitcoin for as long a period of time as possible, and that's what I try and do. And so to accomplish that, debt can be a useful tool in order to hold the Bitcoin for as long as possible and not really play with real dollars, right? You're playing with imaginary dollars. And so it's funny. I tried to get a home equity line of credit, and because I'm so much of my cash flow is Bitcoin based now, they basically said I don't have enough income to qualify for this home equity line of credit. So I'm kind of stuck with you playing the credit card game. Mm-hmm. Last winter, so I heat the house, the homestead, with Bitcoin. And so you're essentially buying KYC free Bitcoin through the expenditure of your electricity and paying the utility company the fiat, and you're buying Bitcoin with this way, right?
And so and heating the house.
And you're getting the heat.
Yeah.
And so there was an opportunity for me to basically my electricity bills are quite expensive in the wintertime versus the summertime because I'm really pumping up the hash rate. Mm. And so I basically did a balance transfer from one credit card to another and paid the utility company with my credit card balance transfer that over to another one. And now I've got 12 months. I just pay 4% up front. And now I've got 12 months to see how the price plays out before I have to pay off that debt. And so I'm starting to pay that off now. And granted, you know, in hindsight, it's 2020. I should have been paying it off over the summer, but I've still got some time. Maybe the price will go back up. But either way, I'm gonna win on that trade. You know, And so you can utilize debt to your advantage when you have Bitcoin, because you're playing this opportunity cost game, right? You get to keep the sats today, and wait to see if the purchasing power increases before you have to pay off whatever that expenditure that you had was.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The use case I'll explain to you, which I proceeded with, is I sold real estate 3 years ago when I only had one child, and then 3 years later had three children. Moving from rental to rental turned out to be much more difficult than I expected to rent a place where we wanted to be. And I was like, enough, we've got to get back into some real estate so I can have a family home for us. But it's like, if I'm going to do that, real estate's the most, not the most, but is a highly, it's a very well-developed market with lots of options to leverage. And it's like, if you're going to get back into real estate from a family home perspective, you want to sell as little Bitcoin as possible and take as much leverage as possible. So, okay, well, what kind of loan to value can I get? And again, like yourself, the bank didn't like me because my demonstrative affordability is very poor, because I live off capital gains, and capital gains are seen as one-off disposals rather than regular forms of income, which they like to leverage against. So the irony being is they prefer you to have a $100,000 a year income and give you a $500,000 loan and be negative equity than have a balance sheet, you know, of whatever that you might be sitting on. And if you have no income, they're like, well, I can't give you a loan. And that's in a sense the extraordinary extraction that you're referring to of the fiat system. So that doesn't make sense. I've got this value sitting right here. I could pay you the loan tomorrow. Why don't you give me a loan? And they're like, no, sorry, I need to see you have an income. Otherwise, my calculator doesn't work. You're like, that's so backwards. But the price at the time, like my net asset calculation, even now, like when I think back to August, was 40% higher than what it is today. And you're like, ouch, that's a big change. Now, I have bought a house during that process and taken leverage. I had to do it through the private lending markets. So it's only a 2 year long duration. And so in 22 months, I've got to think about, well, actually, I've got this quite big loan on this house now. And you're like, it's just so interesting, isn't it? You can get leverage, but like, it's not without its emotional roller coaster that goes with it. And like you said, I'm pretty confident that 2 years from now, it's absolutely going to be a good trade, because there's a whole load of Bitcoin that I didn't have to sell in order to enter that position. But right now, the Bitcoin price has come right off. And you're like, well, if I have to repay it tomorrow, I'm in a bit of problem. So yeah, I guess like anyone listening, like absolutely have a look at these different options, but it doesn't come with a stress-free life. But I do think, you know, it's as you get more sophisticated and better educated, and in particular like asking the question, what is money? You start to see the fiat system for what it is, which is a debt-based credit system. And it's a tool. And if you're able to carry your debt, then leverage is actually very helpful in certain scenarios. So you can use it. I guess I'm just learning a quite serious lesson as to how to do that. So Rev, yeah, does any of that resonate in terms of the feeling of like, oh, the price has come off, damn it, have I got this one wrong?
Well, and you know, there's a couple ways I have come to interact with the price, right? You learn really quick that your assumptions, if you try and pay attention to what people are saying, oh, the price is going to do this, and by this time the price is going to be here, we're going to have a crash soon, you know. If you're trying to make your decisions based on this information, it's really easy to make a wrong choice. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's funny because a lot of the advice is don't use your emotions, use the information to make your decisions. Mm-hmm. And I've actually switched to the opposite. When I'm jumping up and down, if the price is ripping and I wake up in the morning, I'm jumping up and down, I'm having a beer at noon, you know, that's the time for me to spend the Bitcoin on some things that I've had my eye on. And back to the eight forms of capital, it's not like I'm going to go and buy a Lambo, right? And just this frivolous thing, but it's time for me to upgrade my systems, maybe buy a RAM that has better genetics to give me more, more capital, right? To continue for my systems to flow better and work more for me. A good example of that. So I bought a car last December. This is a hybrid electric vehicle. I bought it with Bitcoin from another Bitcoiner. And this was the case. The price at that time was going, it seemed like it was really, I was happy about it, right? I just felt good. And my wife was saying, well, we don't need a car. Why are you buying this car? And I'm like, well, I'm going to be going to all these Bitcoin meetups. This car is going to be really good on gas mileage. And we'll see if this plays out, how this plays out. Because if I spend the Bitcoin on the car now, I might be able to make up for the, like, basically now I'm making the trade that I'm going to make more in fuel savings than the opportunity cost of the price going up. And so Bitcoin has essentially been sideways this whole year. And that ended up being like a really good decision. And that was like a purely emotional kind of like, it, I mean, it wasn't purely emotional, but emotions was what drove me to like say, hey, I should make a big purchase right now. Like the Bitcoin's ripping. I think it's time for me to fire off something that will be useful for us. And it turned out to be a really good choice. And there's another saying that I've got when it comes to price. And that's when the price goes up, you work faster, right? Because you're trying to keep up the sales that you can make today. The sooner you can make that sale, the sooner you get, you're getting full exposure and you're riding the price up. And when the price goes down, you work harder. And you have to work harder because you have to convince people that now is the time to let go of their sats for your thing. But if you can stack when the price is down, now you're getting the most Bitcoin for your time.
Yeah.
So price goes up, work faster. Price goes down, work harder.
And it's funny, it strikes me. So when you talk about natural capital, the ebb and flow of life is natural. You know, you don't wake up feeling fucking amazing every day. And I think it's very difficult when Bitcoin is this new thing, right? Digital scarcity, digital sound money, a measuring stick for value that's better than anything that's ever come before it. And so, of course, it's going to be a process of trial and error, a process of finding product market fit, a process of adoption. But it doesn't mean that you know how it's going to feel. But, of course, life itself is up and down. And so everything we're talking through here, it strikes me as it's very natural. So I know natural capital, you're referring more to like your livestock and things like this, but does Bitcoin fit into that sense of like, it fits in much better than fiat currency, essentially, to your forms of capital?
Well, I think that Bitcoin is really the first natural digital system, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
It much more follows closely the laws of nature than it does of any other digital thing. And so, and people often complain about the volatility of Bitcoin making it hard. And that's why it's so hard to be a hodler, right? Because you have to have the diamond hands and your conviction is constantly being tested. But when you live this homesteading lifestyle like I do, I mean, the volatility of nature is equally as bad, if not worse. There's things you walk out the door every morning and you don't know what the fuck's going to be happening out there. Recently, a storm came through. A tree fell on the fence where I had my rams. The rams got out. And so I walk out in the morning with my coffee going to give the hay to my ewes, the female sheep. And there's, our dairy ram in there. And he's breeding them. And we didn't want him to be bred right now. And so I'm like, okay, here we go. Got to get this guy. What happened? Get the ram out of there. Find the hole in the fence. And I'm like, wait a second. Our other ram's gone. Our prized ram, like this a Katahdin hair sheep registered ram. The most valuable sheep we have. Gone. Like,
fuck.
Just totally disappeared. And so we go spend time looking for him and everything. It's been a month, haven't found the guy. He got eaten by coyotes. He's gone. And so, you know, when you're working with nature and this natural capital stuff, the volatility is insane. The saying, don't count your chickens before they hatch, right? You can have all these eggs in the incubator and you're like, oh man, I have 50 eggs in my incubator and I'm going to have 50 chickens and then I'll be able to sell all the pullets for this much. And I'm going to be able to produce this many eggs. And you make all these calculations based on these eggs in the incubator that haven't hatched yet. And then something happens and half the eggs don't hatch or you lose the whole batch. And if you made bets based on that, if you started to leverage up, you know, starting to make deals in advance based on these chickens that you thought you were going to have, you're in big trouble. And so you start to learn to like not like stay humble, stack sats. You know, you stay humble and just let nature play out and respond more than make your plans around it.
And sorry, Rev, I wasn't expecting your story to end up with such a disaster that your lead ram just disappeared. I'm sorry about that. The thing that got me giggling was like the comic concept of like walking out the front door and like, oh my God, anything can happen. And I was hoping for a happier end to that story. I'm so sorry that that happened. The process though, so what I'd love to learn more, what does a day look like when you're managing a homestead? So what is your, I mean, obviously every day is going to be different. You're talking about the volatility of nature. But just walk me through like, you know, what have you done today? And you wake up, you're like, okay, I've got all these tasks to achieve. How do you go through it?
Well, I think it's seasonal, right? So there's different, we've learned that you build your routine based around what season it is and what's going on. And so we've also learned that, you know, you can't suddenly have the routine ready to switch right at the change of the season. It's sort of like a continuous ebb and flow. One, by the time you've finally gotten into the rhythm of one season, you're in that rhythm for a month, and then it's starting to transition into the rhythm of the next season. And so we could take like, I mean, I made some videos on Noster over the summertime of like a day in the life of the homestead.
Cool.
And so that's kind of I'll start with that example, right? So I get out the door. You got the chores to do, right? So in my instance, I start with my chickens. And so I bring the food scraps out to the chickens, give them a couple of scoops of the grain. And my chickens, what I use them for is to compost my horse manure. And so every day I bring, I turn the compost piles. I rebuild the compost piles that I built in there the day before. This is giving my chickens access to worms and fly larvae and whatever else. And my chickens are doing the work of turning this compost for me. And then they're paying me in food. They're paying me in eggs for that work. I collect the eggs. And then I go get my wheelbarrow. I collect 2 wheelbarrow loads of horse manure. I dump that into the chicken area, build a new fresh pile of compost for them to work. And then I take the finished compost that the chickens have made, take that wheelbarrow of finished compost, add it to a garden, put it somewhere where I need fertility. Maybe I'm putting it in bags and selling it at a Bitcoin meetup. After that, then I've got to give my horses their hay if they need hay, feed some hay to the rams, feed my rabbits. And so I've got a rabbit colony integrated with the cannabis garden. And so my rabbits actually grow my cannabis for me. And rabbits are cool because they're vegetarians. And unlike a chicken, chickens are omnivores. This is why the compost works so well to feed the chickens, because they need bugs in their diet to produce those high quality eggs. A rabbit, on the other hand, does not need anything but vegetative material. And so I'll do some weeding. I'll take that wheelbarrow after I've dumped the compost somewhere. I'll weed some area, like maybe my food forest, for example, where I've got all this perennial garden intermixed with where I grow subsistence crops, garlic, potatoes, onions, squash, carrots, that sort of stuff, in with fruit trees, berries, hazelnuts, that sort of thing. And so that area needs a little bit of weeding. I fill up a wheelbarrow full of weeds. I take that wheelbarrow of weeds. I mulch around the base of my cannabis plants. And this is food for my rabbits. My rabbits eat the weeds that I've fed them. They're now weeding now they're depositing their fertility at the base of the cannabis plant. And that helps. And this is the other thing that's cool about rabbits, is that their manure is not hot. Unlike any of the other manures at the homestead, the chicken manure, horse manure, sheep manure, all those manures need compost time, aging time before you can actually feed them to a plant. Rabbit manure is special. It's directly accessible to the plant right out of the animal. And so by feeding the rabbits at the base of the plant, now I'm actually feeding my cannabis too. And so I'm taking my weeds from my area where I'm growing my annuals and perennials. I'm, instead of composting that, I'm turning that into rabbit meat. And then I'm also feeding my cannabis mulching my cannabis. And so you could, the chores kind of like go on like that for the morning, right before lunch. And then I've got some short-term rentals here. I built a tiny house and a yurt, which I access the ecotourism of my area. I'm not far from Chicago, so there's a lot of people that come to my area to come stay nightly and enjoy the homestead lifestyle. I'm about 15 minutes from the beach at Lake Michigan. So there's people coming to go to the beach, hang out at the homestead, enjoy the animals and stuff that we've got here. And so I might be turning over one of those units or both of them. And then it's lunchtime, you know. And then after lunch, then it's like, what do I have to fix? What do I have to, like, that's where you kind of get some forward moving progress for the day. You're building on top of a system, you're refining a system, you're fixing a system, not just maintaining
it. It strikes me, Rev, what you just described is like in the morning you're working in your business, then in the afternoon you get to work on it. So there'll be something right. that needs your attention to make sure it functions. And so, and so lunch, are you always eating something that you've created from your homestead?
That's the goal, you know, basically the way we've got things set up is that we produce enough food to where we don't need the grocery store, right? Like we could eat and survive off of all the food that we grow here, but the grocery store offers a lot of variety and a lot of convenience. And so there's times in your life where you just, you know, to take a lamb and slaughter it and butcher it and cut it up into the different parts and then freeze it and then thaw it and then prepare the meal, right? There's a lot of steps involved in from taking that live animal and turning it into food for yourself. And so sometimes you're busy and you just want to, you know, something convenient and easy from the grocery store. Slice deli meat, right? Make a sandwich and eat the sandwich and go on with your day. And so we try to eat as much as well that we produce as possible. This is obviously lowering our overhead, our expense, like our lifestyle cost in general, but it's not always the case. Like I don't like to ever speak in absolutes when it comes to this kind of thing, right? There is definitely some trade-offs that you can make that are good for you. If the grocery store ceases to exist, I'll be just fine, you know, but we do access the grocery store.
It's incredible sovereignty when you describe that. And I'm the opposite end of the scale where I'm currently renting the real estate that I'm living in and I'm buying my food from a store, a different store every single day. I mean, I guess that was one of the lessons of the COVID experience. I was actually in central Melbourne, which was one of the worst lockdowns everywhere. I owned a house at the time, but it's 195 square meters. And you walk out the front door onto the government's pavement and they control everything. And at the time, there was a COVID testing center that was put up on the street. So there were people queuing up on my front gate waiting to get a test to see if they could travel overseas or interstate. It was crazy. But I didn't know where my water was coming from. I didn't know where my food was coming from. I didn't know where my electricity was coming from. And even though I did think that I owned a house, it was quite clearly in someone else's fiefdom, because you're now not allowed to go to the grocery store, you know, more than 5 kilometers away, or you can't go and see a family member, or you can't go to the sports stadium unless you get this medicine, or whatever the case might be. It's interesting in a sense that 4 or 5 years later, I'm still living in that similar tangent. And what you've just described is like the complete opposite end of the spectrum, where it's like, no, okay, well, I could survive without a grocery store. I mean, wow, that's so different. And you talk about stored capital. Like, that's an amazing thing to be able to fall back on. I'm intrigued because as a home chef, like, we're really into our health and always investing in it. And we're very specific about what we do eat and what we don't eat. Eating your own food directly out of the land around where you're sleeping every day, it must be incredible quality. You know exactly what's got into it. Like, do you feel different from 10 years ago before you started this process?
Yeah. And this is kind of where it comes into that vital capital component, right? Your mental health and physical well-being.
Yeah, cool.
Not only do I get the health benefits of the high quality food that I'm producing, but I get the health benefits of actually producing it, because it takes physical work and it's you're very proud of the things that you produce. This is good for your mental health. You know, when I have a hand in my own sustenance and the sustenance for my family, this gives me a lot of strength. And so it's kind of this compounded effect where not only are you getting these like physical health benefits from the nutritional quality of the food, but you're actually getting all of the mental health benefits from producing it, the physical health benefits from actually using your own effort, your muscle to produce it. And so Bitcoin really, you know, it enables, I like to think that we live this like future, what the future looks like of living a subsistence lifestyle. Maybe it's been longer than 100 years ago now, but roughly 100 years ago, let's say, natural capital was like one of the most valuable forms of capital, because that was the ability to produce food. And it wasn't like you could just ship food from one continent to the other.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Locally, the excess natural capital that you had a lot high level of liquidity, right? Because if someone had a hard time and they couldn't produce their food. Now you can provide that to them, right? There's a much higher market for it. And so the natural capital now with Bitcoin, right? It's the purchasing power that you gain allows you to sort of make that short-term sacrifice in building up the systems to produce your natural capital again. And it's like when you buy food at the grocery, like if I were to buy the quality of food that I produce here, I couldn't afford it, right? Wow. To exchange my Bitcoin for the same level of quality that I'm actually growing myself. So I'm actually saving Bitcoin in a sense, and not having to sacrifice my vital capital by buying lower quality food, extra processed food, so on and so forth. And so because I have the Bitcoin, it enables me to actually live this higher standard of living but I'm not necessarily like extremely wealthy as far as financial capital is concerned. It just gives me this savings account that gives me the stability to now focus on natural capital.
But like, what is wealth in that sense, Rev? Like, you know, the more I've studied it in a sense, I think wealth is time. And the more time that you have to yourself to investigate under your own steam, whatever it is you might be interested in, whether that's homeschooling your children or living off the land or whatever the case might be, that's wealth. So you can have a financial wealth figure that would blow people's minds. But if you have to work 366 days a year, 18 and a half hours a day to get that, like, is that actually wealth? And the fiat system incentivizes that. It comes back to that, like, oh, mate, your income's not strong enough. I can't give you a loan. It's like, yeah, but look at the balance sheet. And they don't even care about that. It's like, okay, well, obviously people are going to work as long and as hard as possible to try and increase that fiat number. But at what cost? And the morning that you've painted is so interesting. It's like, okay, I've got a morning's worth of work to do to sustain the momentum of my homestead. And then I'm going to take a break, feed myself. And then the afternoon is about how do I increase the capital or the momentum of my homestead? And I think that's so cool because that's wealth. You know, you've bought yourself half a day or whatever the case might be to do that. I had one last question, Rev, that I wanted to go through that I heard you describe yourself, or someone asked you if you were a mad scientist. So this is just, we'll spend 5-10 minutes on this before wrapping it up. Do you like to make experiments? Were you always curious as a young boy? And like, what is a mad scientist? Like, I feel like we need more mad scientists in the world.
Yeah, I think I feel like it a lot of times, because I do a lot of the mad science, the most like obvious stuff you could look at for what I put out there as far as the mad scientist stuff is concerned is the work that I do with the Bitcoin miners. Mm. And I've always, as a kid, I was always kind of handy. You know, I used to like to ride BMX bikes and skateboard and stuff. And so I was always building ramps. And even before that, I was building tree houses and just like taking whatever junk I could find in the garage and making this into something that I could utilize. And so my style is very makeshift. You know, there's some people out there that they have excellent engineering prowess, and then they take the time to really get the right materials and make it look nice. And I like to work, and this comes a lot down to like the permaculture principles. So there's a permaculture principle, produce no waste, use and value renewable resources and materials. And basically, when you start to look at these permaculture principles, what it suggests and what it distills down to is like, use what you have first, try and utilize what's in front of you first, rather than going out and getting this outside input to work with. And so the reason why a lot of my stuff looks like mad scientist work is because I'm trying to find any old bucket or broken piece of junk or whatever and repurpose that. And a lot of times I'm repurposing that into maybe a Bitcoin mining hot water heater, or a Bitcoin mining clothes dryer, or a Bitcoin mining food dehydrator. I have very little outside investment in these contraptions, and they look like that. You know, they look like a contraption made out of trash and junk, but it mines Bitcoin and it does the thing that I want it to do. Cool. And one of the beauties of when you build things with trash like this, and you could kind of think and I don't know if this is true or not, but I romanticize the idea of the Native Americans. They have these teepees, right? Mm. That structure does not last forever, you know? And so you could imagine being a young man, an Indian, and today your dad's like, you're going to build your first teepee today. And you go and you find out how to cut the wood down and you tan the skins and you build this teepee, and it's like a piece of shit and it lasts only a year and it degrades, right? And even the father's teepee will degrade. He's really good at it. His teepee degrades in 5 years or something, right? But you're constantly having to rebuild the teepee out of stuff that you can find in the environment and hone the craft. And each time you do it, you build a better teepee. And so when it comes to these Bitcoin mining contraptions, I start off with the junk that I've got laying around. I build the contraption. It does the thing. And then it fails for most of the time because I built it out of junk. And if someone had built it with all of this, the right materials, right material might be the wrong word, but with these outside materials,
purpose-built for the
application to start with, it's going to last a lot longer. But I get to iterate my way into something that lasts a long time and have much less. I have to spend very little sats in that process.
It's almost like a prototyping process. So you're creating a minimum viable product somehow. You're proving the use case. And then if you chose to spend your sats on creating something, you've got a much better understanding of whether or not it will work. Yeah, very cool. And that in itself, that is capital stewardship or capital growth management at its very core. Well, Rev, listen, okay, so we're running up to like the 90-minute mark. So I'm going to say thank you so much for your time and thank you so much for sharing everything you have today. I really love learning from people, and the fact that we're able to jump on a video call and have a conversation like this in completely different parts of the world doing completely different things is a real pleasure. So thank you. If anyone wants to reach out and get in touch, what's the best way to do that?
Well, you can find me on Nostr. That's pretty much where I hang out. That's the good touch point to find me. I'm Rev Hodel on Nostr, not to be confused with Reverend Hodel. There's another guy over there. We get mixed up all the time. I'm not Reverend Hodel. I'm just Rev, Rev.Hodel. Find me on Nostr, connect with me. Happy to talk about permaculture, talk about Bitcoin mining, talk about ways to live life on a Bitcoin standard, whatever. And another thing I can close out with too is just,
please.
So a lot of the stories and a lot of the stuff I talked about, just to relate it back to these nine forms of capital, you've got time, which is a flow, right? You're spending your time. And so you can try and look at all of these examples that I was giving my day to day. And with each expenditure of my time, try and deduce how many forms of capital am I stacking with each expenditure of the time. In my morning routine, am I just doing my chores or am I stacking how many forms of capital am I actually stacking there? The name of the game is to design your life and build the lifestyle around when you spend your time. You've got to be trying to build. If you're aware of this concept, then it becomes much easier to start to say, oh yeah, when I did that trip or when I built this thing or when I had that interaction, I didn't just get the main driving purpose for that expenditure of your time. If you can recognize all of these different things that you might have built on this alongside that, then you can really start to wield this concept and use this concept of the nine forms of capital to your advantage to build a savings that is resilient, which you can then pass to your children and carry this on for future generations.
Awesome. That is the name of the game. It's, you know, how do you steward the humanistic, the intellectual capital to help people then flourish? And of course, your kids are key in that. Well, Rev, thank you so much for your time today.
I'll be, if you guys want to talk again, man, I'm happy to do it. It was great. Good to meet you. Yeah, man, keep at it. Love the podcast. I listened to a few episodes.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks, Rev.